Welcome back to the Reading and Writing Podcast. My guest today is Matthew Harfy, author of the new novel, A Time for Swords. Harfy has written many historical novels, including The Cross and the Curse, The Serpent Sword, and many others. Matthew Harfy, welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you, Jeff. It's great to be here.
Great. Well, if someone hasn't heard about your new novel yet, how would you describe A Time for Swords?
Well, A Time for Swords is the first book in a new series. It's set in AD 793, which any Vikings fans out there will know is the date of the first attack on Lindisfarne, the Holy Island on the east northeast coast of Britain, and by the Vikings. And they came along and pillaged, raped and pillaged, and did their thing. And it sort of kicked off what is commonly known as the Viking Age. So the story of Time for Swords is written from the perspective of a monk who's actually there on the day that the attack happens. He's a young man there, and he's writing the book as an old man looking back on his life. And he realizes, strangely, that when the attack happens and he sees all this destruction around, and nobody was expecting, an attack or anything, and different things happen, and he realizes that he's not going to die and run away like the rest of the people. He's actually going to turn around and fight. So he discovers something within him that is triggered by the events, and he stands and fights, and the rest of the book is recounting his defense, or what had the aftermath, the immediate aftermath of that battle, and how he convinces the king of Northumbria there's going to be future attacks, and how he rallies a motley crew of warriors around him to protect his own home monastery, which is actually not Lindisfarne. He's traveling to Lindisfarne. He's actually from another monastery south in Northumbria called Warkworth is the modern name of the place. And actually it's a real place, but it's a fictional monastery. I created a monastery there that didn't really exist. But I mean, he's convinced for different reasons, which are apparent in the book, that there's going to be another attack. So he creates this a defense ready. And that's it, really.
Great. And do you remember the original idea or impetus that led you to write A Time for Swords?
So I've written other books, as you mentioned, that are set in the early Anglo-Saxon period. So a couple of hundred years before A Time for Swords. Those stories are before the Vikings, but much of the story takes place in the same area. So I've been interested in Lindisfarne and that whole area, and I think one day I just had this thought of I've read quite a few historical fiction or stories that are written by a monk looking back on his life, or by an old man looking back on his life, and sometimes it's a warrior that's become a monk, as an older man, when he's too old to fight, I guess, and he's then sort of recounting his stories. I've read that a couple of times. And I thought, how about having a young monk that becomes a warrior? And I thought, what would happen if the monks that day hadn't just been slaughtered by the Vikings, but actually turned around and defended them? And then I didn't want to make it completely fantasy, so I had to then sort of think of what I could do to create the story in the real timeline. And not have the monks at Lindisfarne turn around and destroy the Vikings and send them packing, but actually what happened next, and there were future attacks. So I've created this fictional place for a secondary attack, and as you're listening to the storyline, you might sort of realize that there's similarities with other classic stories as well. So really, as I started writing, my love of westerns and the Magnificent Seven and Seven Samurai, the Akira Kurosawa movie, exactly. Seven Samurai, started to come into my mind. And I thought, why not have this sort of story of getting the small motley band together to defend against a much superior force, I'm also a massive fan of David Gemmell, the fantasy writer. And his first story, my favorite of his books, is The Legend, which features Druss, the old warrior who is part of a smaller army that defend against a much, much larger army and defends this castle. And so I thought, so all these things in the back of my mind. And the more I wrote, the more I thought this would be a great, interesting take on it. And so I've sort of, then I decided that because there's all the different people in the land of Britain at the time, you've got Welsh, you've got the Anglo-Saxons, you've got Picts, you've got, of course, from Ireland, you've got the Irish. So I thought, why not? I was almost thinking like the old, in Britain, we have very common jokes, which are probably very non-politically correct nowadays, but they used to be very common when I was a kid, which was you've got an Englishman, an Irishman, and a Scotsman. You tell the joke about each one of the people, and they would have some sort of stereotypical response to whatever happens in the joke. And I sort of got this thinking. I thought, why don't I get this band and have a Pict from Scotland and an Irishman, a Northumbrian, and put them all together. So I got this sort of motley crew and band of people, and there's a Viking in there as well. So one of the Vikings that's in the original attack for different reasons ends up shipwrecked or abandoned, not shipwrecked, but abandoned in Lindisfarne, and he manages to keep alive, and Hunlaf, who's the main character, convinces the Northumbrians not to kill him, and ends up getting him on side and defending against the secondary attack. So you've got this group of a small number of warriors, which may or may not number seven at some point, I think.
Well, what was your writing journey that led you to writing and getting your first novel published?
Okay, so I started writing the very first book. So the first book is the first book of the Benicio Chronicles, which is the long series that I've got. It's still ongoing. I haven't finished that one. And that's the one that starts in 633. And the first book is called The Serpent Sword. And I started writing that back in 2001. And the catalyst for that really was I've always been interested in fantasy novels, as I mentioned, historical fiction, action, adventure sort of stories. And I lived for a few years as a child. I lived on the northeast coast of England in Northumberland, which I loved. I always remember really fondly, and I loved the landscape and all the sort of ruined castles and everything. And it has an important place in my story. I was alone in the house. I think our little daughter was asleep, and my wife was out working late. And I was watching a documentary, and it talked about how Northumbria in the 7th century, 8th century in Britain was an incredibly important kingdom. And I had no idea. I'd lived there for a few years as a child, as I said, and I had no idea. And it talked about the fact that really for a couple of hundred years, or at least 150 years or so, Northumbria was, one of the most important kingdoms in Europe, which was basically the known world at the time. And it was incredible. And so I didn't know anything about this. And straight away after watching this, this documentary, I went upstairs and turned the old computer on that I had at the time and started to write and what turned into The Serpent Sword. Obviously, I didn't finish it very quickly, and I didn't actually manage to publish it until 2015, I think I finally published that one. So that took a while, but I put it away for a long time in the middle. I got really disheartened by just seeing other books coming out that I thought were very similar. The Last Kingdom came out by Bernard Cornwell. It was set in the same sort of place a couple of hundred years later. And I thought, no one's going to think I've copied him. So I put it aside. And then later on, I realized that, if I couldn't traditionally publish, I could self-publish. And I ended up self-publishing The Serpent Sword. I got an agent, but he couldn't sell it. I then ended up self-publishing it, and it sold quite well. Then, strangely enough, when you manage to self-publish something and sell quite a few copies, then publishers are interested. So then I got traditionally published, I took that decision to go traditional. And since then, I've been traditionally published with Head of Zeus is the publisher. It's an independent publisher in the UK.
Right. And so what was the research process for researching the Viking era for A Time of Swords?
Okay, so, well, as I say, I've done lots of research about the Anglo-Saxon, British Anglo-Saxon period of a couple of hundred years before. And one of the things that I didn't want to do was jump to a completely different time frame that would necessitate doing a massive amount of research. So I naively, I think, at the time thought, well, if I just move a couple of hundred years later, you know, it's all the same. It's just Anglo-Saxons and Vikings. It'd be fine. And so I sort of, that was my initial thinking. And then, of course, the more I've written, you know, I finished Clan of Swords, I'm writing the sequel now. And I realized that there's so much I don't know about the period. So I've written most of the Clan of Swords and all of the sequels so far during the pandemic. So my research has been books, YouTube, and using the internet for, you know, Google searching and watching YouTube videos of people sailing and going around different places. And because now in the second book, it comes as no surprise. I said Hunlaf is the narrator, so you know he survives the end of the first book. At the end in the second book, he's heading out across the sea, actually to the land of the Vikings, to Norway, which of course I know nothing about, and I've never been to Norway. So so now I'm having to do lots of research, as I say, by Google Earth and.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
When you visit Arizona, time is measured in moments, not minutes. Like the moment you see the Grand Canyon for the first time. Visit a new state of mind. Learn more at hereyouareaz.com.
I've got the rough guide to Norway, you know, and things like that. So I'm actually just reading everything I can about the place they're going. And one of the best things actually is, as I say, is watching YouTube videos to get an idea of what it's like on the ground and see people walking around some of the places that I'm trying to emulate. And of course, then casting my mind back 1,000+ years and trying to work out what it would have been like then. And there's not a huge amount written about the time in Britain or in Norway at the time. You know, when you start looking at the history, lots of the detailed history of the Vikings that's written down comes much later. It was written down 200 or 300 or 400 years after the events. And so it's quite nebulous. So one of the reasons why it's great, and well, it's a double-edged sword, but partly it's great to write about what's commonly known as the Dark Ages or the early medieval period, is that there are so many gaps in our knowledge that it allows, you know, lots of stories to be kind of made up and you know, pushed into the gaps. Nobody can say you're wrong as long as you stick to what is known.
Gotcha.
And so, yeah.
Well, you mentioned David Gimmel's novel Legend. Are there other authors and books that have kind of inspired your own writing along the way?
There's lots. I mentioned Bernard Cornwell as well. Obviously, Bernard Cornwell is a big influence. In fact, I mean, it was when he brought out The Last Kingdom, and which is now a TV series, and there's a long running, it's finished now. It's a long series of books about the Viking and Anglo-Saxon period. That was after I'd started writing the Bernicia Chronicles, as I said, but the books that really inspired me, I think, to actually start writing the Bernicia Chronicles were the three Arthurian novels that Bernard Cornwell wrote in the 90s, and I'd love those. The first one is called The Winter King, and they're very realistic. They're set in the end of after the Romans have left, before the Vikings, in that sort of really dark period when it isn't very much written history at all. And he just tells a fantastic retelling of the Arthur of the Arthurian legends based in sort of a historical reality, if you like. So there's Merlin and there's all the characters you'd expect, but you know, everyone believes in magic and they believe in they believe that Merlin's a wizard and stuff, but it's never overt in the story. It's never really said that, you know, you get the feeling that actually it's, you know, it's just the real world and he's just a very clever man who manages to convince people that he's, you know, blessed by the gods and things like that. So it's so that was probably one of the biggest inspirations. And another author, Con Eagledon, who's got lots of historical fiction novels. He wrote, and he's also a huge fan of David Gemmell. And he's written a series about Julius Caesar and another series about Genghis Khan. And I'm reading one of his books, actually, an advanced copy, called Protector, by Con Eagledon. And that's set in ancient Greece, and that's around the Battle of Plataea. So, yeah, there's lots of great historical fiction authors. Just think of another one, Justin Hill. He's another great writer who's written a book called Shield Wall and Viking Fire, set in the 11th century, and he's a fantastic writer.
Great. I was curious about your writing process. You talked about when you initially watched that documentary and then lit up and turned on your computer and started writing. Do you, when you do have an idea, do you normally sit down and plot the novel, or do you just kind of try to dive into the story and see where it leads you?
Yeah, so so the short answer is I tried to plot, but I plot at a very sort of high level, so almost at the at the chapter, like a few lines for a chapter, really that sort of level, so that when I do get to that part of the story, things will have evolved, and there's enough scope for me to flesh things out and to sort of go where the story takes me to some extent. But I kind of know, you know, where the end point is, and I try to know what the end point is with each chapter and each scene. But I'm trying to think if right back in the beginning I wrote like that, I'm not really sure. I think at the very beginning it was a bit more fluid, and so that's probably why it took me so long. But now I've worked out that it's actually a lot better if I focus some sort of planning, you know, I know where I'm going. But with the Time for Swords, the sequel, and because it's going to Norway, and I've not been able to actually get out and, you know, visit any of the places I'm writing about, I found it more difficult. And I don't know if it's partly because of the pandemic and stuff, but maybe I found it more difficult to plan. You know, I'm sort of planning and thinking I know where I'm going, and I get down to sit down and think, oh, what's happening next? And I maybe haven't done as much planning as I should have done. But
gotcha. So what writing advice would you offer for those who are listening, who are working on their own stories and novels?
One of the pieces of advice that one of the most important pieces of advice, I think, is to finish what you start. And I think there are many, many people out there who say, you know, I could write a novel. I want to write a book. You know? And I'd never written a novel before The Serpent Sword. Two or three times in my life, I would sit down and think, oh, I've got a great idea. And I'd start writing. I'd write three or four pages. And then that's it. And then you just sort of run out of steam and could never sort of write anymore. And, I think by planning the whole novel from beginning to end, just to even at a high level, you give yourself the more of a chance, I think, of completing it. But I think really it's that finishing the book. I think that's the most important thing, really. I mean, they say you write every day. I don't think you need to write every day, but I think you need to write frequently. And I think you need to sit down and actually spend the time. And even if you only write, you know, set yourself goals per week that you think are doable. And you know, that could be 1,000 words a week or 2,000 words a week. But I mean, if you do 2,000 words a week, and a novel's about 100,000 words, then, you know, 50 weeks in a year, you've finished a novel, right? So you can finish a novel quite relatively quickly if you sit down and force yourself to actually write, even when it's difficult. But if you don't finish a novel, you're never going to get published. You know, so I think that's the important thing, is that if you sit down to write something, finish it, then you can publish it. If you sit down and write and never finish anything, you're never going to get it published. So that's it.
Gotcha. So I I wasn't sure if you said earlier, have you already finished the sequel to A Time for Swords?
I haven't finished it. No, I'm writing at the moment. It's okay. As yet untitled. I'm about 80,000 words. I was working about 10 minutes before speaking to you. So I'm about 80,000 words in, which should be sort of rounding up, you know, sort of building up towards the end of the story, but I'm not. So I think it's going to be quite long. So I'm thinking it's going to be, I normally aim for 100,000 and overshoot. This one, I think I'm definitely going to overshoot by quite a lot. But A Time for Swords was about 150,000 words, and I think this one's going to be the same, or maybe even slightly longer, perhaps.
And so do you think there will be others beyond just two?
Yes, I think so. I haven't got them all mapped out. I think maybe that's one of the things I should do when I'm doing a series, but I haven't. And it's sort of, I think that's part of what's come to bite me doing the sequel to this one, is trying to, you know, to make sure that I tie in some of the things that I've mentioned in the first book. Because one of the things I do in the first book, it's the first book I've written in first person. That's with A Time for Swords, which is one of the things that also I'm, with each book, I try to do something a bit different to make it interesting for me. And I thought, well, I'll try and write this one in first person, which is a real challenge. It's a real different challenge. But one of the things that I've done, because it's an old man looking back, I decided, I don't know if I decided or just did it a bit, and then my editor said, you know, do more of that. But in the end, there's quite a few references to things that happen, that are going to happen in his life. You know, so he says, you know, he mentions right from the beginning that he travels all over the world, that he goes to Constantinople and Rome. And, you know, he mentions later that he was shipwrecked off of Africa or something. I mean, all these different things. None of those things were plotted or thought out in my mind. So I've got all of these ideas that I've kind of just dropped two lines into the first book. And I now have to think other ways that I can bring those out and sort of tease them into the novel proper, into a proper novel.
And so I'm curious too, do you have plans for more books in the Benicia Chronicles?
Yes. So I've written the eighth one. I'm trying to make sure it's the right one. So For Lord of Land, I think, is the eighth one. And that's coming out in July this year. So that's already written and edited and everything. And I'm already contracted to write the next one of those as well. So the ninth one, don't know what the title is going to be, but number eight ends on a bit of a cliffhanger. And that follows a character called Beobrand. And he starts up as a young man, very much like Hunlef starts very young, but he starts up as a young man, and he by the time of For Lord of Land, he's like in his late 30s, and he's just about to become a grandfather, I think, at that point. And so, you know, he's really grown up, but he's now an important warlord, and he's embroiled in the different machinations of the kings of Northumbria and all sorts of other places. And so, yeah, there's going to be at least two or three more of those, I think. So probably, I'd sort of nominally, I'd say about 12 in that series, but I'm not sure exactly the number. There are gaps that I could go back and fill in as well if I really felt like it.
Right. Well, where can people find you online if they want to learn more about you and your novels?
Okay, so my website is matthewharfy.com. Harfy, for anyone listening and hasn't got anything in front of them to read, it's HARFY. And so yeah, matthewharfy.com. And I'm on Twitter as Matthew Harfy as well, and Matthew Harfy author on Facebook, and yeah, all the links are anyway on that website. So you can find me from there on Instagram and everything.
Great. Well, again, we've been speaking with Matthew Harfy, author of the new novel A Time for Swords. The novel is on sale now, so go buy a copy. And Matthew, thanks for doing this interview.
Thanks very much, Jeff. It's been great.
Great.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
If you've struggled for years to lose weight and have given up hope, did you know you can now access GLP-1 prescription medications at TryLifeMD.com? We're now offering eligible patients online access to GLP-1s, the breakthrough prescription medication that can help you lose body fat and weight. Listen to what people are saying.
It's fun to put on jeans that you couldn't get into 6 months ago.
Every morning, I look forward to getting on the scale.
For anybody who's struggling with their weight, it's a godsend.
And here's the best part. Your insurance may cover 100% of the cost of your medication. So go to TryLifeMD.com to have your eligibility checked right now. Get started today at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.